Okay, you said that was very cloudy.
It was cloudy. I mean, I wasn't involved in the vaccine, actually inoculating people and believing that that wasn't my thing. That was his thing with nurses, and nurses went out with him and did the inoculating in this area. There are several myths that have arisen that he gave the vaccine first to his children, and they were the ones who got it first. Well, if that's true, then my children got it at the same time, but that's never in the myth. Other people in the lab brought their children in, and all of the children of the lab, I mean, if you're going to go out and vaccinate kids in Falk School or in public schools, you better make sure you do your own kids first.
All children?
Yeah, there was a day when all children were asked to come, you know, anybody wanted their kids vaccinated to come in.
Now, was this the live virus?
Oh, no. This is
okay.
A kill virus.
Okay.
Because
we'll talk about that, too. Yeah, right.
And the first real studies that were done on patients at the D.T. Watson home. Now, these were people who were recovering from polio and were being rehabilitated under rehabilitation. It was a rehabilitation center, mostly polio patients. And, of course, going there, you were inoculating groups who already had antibodies. And so what you could see there, that you could inoculate it and it wouldn't cause any abscesses or any bad reactions, and that they would have an antibody rise, that is, that the vaccine would boost their serum titers. But these were among the first people done.
That's the Watson home, or what?
D.T. Watson home out somewhere. Mm-hmm. Sewickley.
Yes. Was it them too?
Yeah, it was the same place.
Okay.
Curtis.
There's talk now, Dr. Youngner. It's interesting. I just heard about it, and I also knew of, I have a friend who was quite concerned. Is it that there can be, that there have been people that have had polio who, a very, very mild case, no paralysis, and that there is a chance of reoccurrence. Is that true?
Well, there is something that people who've had polio and have had limbs affected and had mild cases and recovered without any residual. Some few years ago, they started to notice that these people were coming down with some kind of paralysis or weakness in these limbs. Nobody's figured out what it is. Nobody knows. I don't know how prevalent it is. I haven't read anything about it more recently. But a few years ago, it was in the news and in the medical literature, and it hadn't been decided what that was all about.
How does it feel to be involved in something like the polio vaccine and to put the work into it that you have? It's just a curiosity that I have that you did such an incredible amount of the work. Is that the inner satisfaction of being able then to also enjoy the person like Dr. Salk, who got certainly more of the, was more known for it, certainly than...
Only.
Okay, and how does that feel?
Terrible. I mean, he turned out, as the project got closer and closer to culmination, he obviously... was perfectly willing to take all the credit. And it was a combination of circumstances. Don't forget that the Polio Foundation had put millions of dollars into this project. They also were now claiming to solve a major disease problem. Also, Basil O'Connor, who was president of the National Foundation, had been a law partner of Roosevelt, who had been the founder of the foundation and first president. And O'Connor...
You mean Franklin?
Franklin,
yes.
Roosevelt, and who had suffered from polio.
Right.
And Basil O'Connor obviously saw this as his apotheosis. I mean, he was now going to solve a problem that even Franklin Roosevelt in his lifetime couldn't solve, and this was going to be his contribution. Also, it was a practical matter of the foundation continuing to raise money, lots of money, when they have this success. And it's much easier to do that when you have a hero to somebody's name that you can push. So they had an enormous public relations department that took up Jonas's name as the hero, which he deserved every bit of it, but What happened in the meantime is that Jonas was, how shall I say, not very generous to his colleagues, to put it mildly. And he made sure that nobody else was ever mentioned.
How can you do that?
Well, when you have the newspapers and a powerful public relations organization like the National Foundation, and you're cooperating with them, it's very easy to do it. You see, it was done.
And how do you
before
keep...
You could, then what do you do after that?
How do you keep your mouth shut?
Well, shut to whom?
Okay, well, that's my question.
Well, you see, there's a difference between the scientific community and what they knew, and the public and what they knew. So his reputation for doing that didn't do him any good with the scientific community. And to this day, for instance, you would expect somebody like him, this mythic figure, to be a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Well, he's never been elected. And in part, it's because of his treatment of his colleague, especially me.
Especially you.
Especially me. Because of the colleagues, it turns out that I was the only one who went on and had an independent career. I mean, you could say the others were all technicians and didn't ever do anything. But it was very hard for him to say that was me. And so the best way to do it was to ignore me, which he did. And it was very painful. For instance, this is well documented. If you read the books on polio, they all go over this incident. That this was the big announcement in 1955 in Ann Arbor, when the field trial. There was a big ceremonial announcement in Ann Arbor of the results of the field trial, and the man Thomas Francis, who had been his mentor in Ann Arbor, who had agreed to head this field trial and do it independent of Jonas. You know, Pittsburgh was out of it. They, you know, had to be done independently with placebos, and they did hundreds of thousands of children that summer, and they studied the polio already. And it was a big announcement, but it was a big success. And so I and the other people in the lab were invited to come to Ann Arbor and be in the audience there. And at one point, Jonas got up then to make his speech after the results were announced, and he proceeded to thank everybody who made this possible: Basil O'Connor, the scientific director Harry Weaver of the Polio Foundation. Thanked the dean of the medical school and the head of the university and the head of D.T. Watson Home and on, and never once mentioned anybody who worked in the lab. We were sitting there. And so I got up and somebody else and I flew out. I had a meeting in San Francisco. I had to do the paper, so I left from Willow Run Airport and went to California, and then came back, and of course everybody in California was very congratulatory and so forth, and were very embarrassed by the fact that, you know, in the newspapers there was nothing about anybody else before Jonas. But I came back, and the newspapers were filled with the Salk's triumphant return from Ann Arbor. You know, they got off the Allegheny Airlines plane, or Capital Airlines, whatever it is, flew to Willow Run, and they were met by crowds of reporters and came down the steps, and pictures were taken and newsreels and everything else, and the kilos returned. Well, when I came back from San Francisco, my wife said that she had gotten a call from Mrs. Salk, and we were very good friends with them. We had very warm family relations with them. And she got a call from Mrs. Saul, who said, you know, we're really disappointed in you and your husband. And Jill said, why? And she said, because you haven't called and congratulated us or sent us a telegram or anything. We haven't heard anything from you. And my wife said to her, pardon the expression, Donna, go fuck yourself, and hung up on her. And that was the end of our relationship. Now, when I came back, he confronted me. He said, you know, this was no way for your wife to talk. I mean, it's true, you didn't congratulate us. He said, well, even Max Laufer congratulated us. Now, Max Laufer was head of biophysics here. He was the one who brought Jonas to Pittsburgh. He was a very prominent scientist here in the university. He had brought Jonas here to start an animal virus division in Pittsburgh. He had this virus he worked on a plant virus, and he wanted Jonas to work on animal virus, and somebody else that he brought in starting this virology project. And he was instrumental in bringing Jonas here. And Jonas had completely undercut him, and as soon as he got money from the foundation, had cut himself off from Max Laufer altogether, and had completely gone over to the medical school and had nothing to do with Max Laufer's original intent. So Max Laufer was really angry, especially after the polio thing started to work. He really was angry that this had been, he could have been under his aegis, and Jonas had seen fit to go away, so that they were really hostile to one another. It was very bad feelings between them. And he says to me, even Max Laufer called me a congratulator. And I said to him, you mean you put me in the same category as Max Laufer? It was unbelievable. In any event, our final break came not then, because there was a lot of work to do then. And then our final break came on at the time of the Cutter incident. And you know, the Cutter incident, where there was vaccine that was tainted with live virus and it produced polio and affected a certain number, a couple of hundred people, and a couple of deaths.
What was the year of that? Do you remember?
55.
Right till now?
Oh, yeah, because you see, there was a lot of political pressure. See, the pharmaceutical houses had started to make vaccine in preparation for the successful announcement of the field trial. There were four or five companies that were making vaccine, and they had vaccine ready. And as soon as the field trial was announced, there was enormous pressure on Eisenhower and the secretary of, I guess, what was he called? Health, Education, and Welfare. A woman named Ovida Culp Hobby secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And there was enormous pressure on them to release the vaccine for general use that these pharmaceutical houses had made. There are others who felt that this was very premature because the standards and the testing was what we had done everything on a small scale. And it's well known that when you scale things up to mass scale, that things, conditions aren't exactly the same. So you have to really look hard at what happens when you scale up procedures. And it turned out that the pressures were very great on the government.
So you think did things get sloppy, or is it just inevitable? And who is, I'm not familiar with Cutter, was that?
Cutter, it was Cutter Laboratories. They're still in existence, but they don't make vaccine anymore. They're owned by somebody else now. I can walk miles.
So it was Cutter Lab, and where were they located?
In Oakland.
And at that point you broke with Dr. Hawk?
Yeah.
Why?
Okay. Now,
because I felt that he was in large part responsible, not for the poor production there, but for failing to heed warnings that this was coming. And he came out smelling like a rose. Anyway,
could you now connect Dr. Sabin in here? I'd like to just, I might as well.
Well, Sabin was an older man than Salk. Sabin was a very well-known scientist, had worked on many different diseases, had made many contributions, and he had started working sometime in the 50s on a live virus vaccine.
And that was in California?
No. Sabin was in Cincinnati.
Okay.
And others were doing this too. Men and Kaprowski at Letterly.
Where's Letterly?
Letterly is in Pearl River, New York.
Okay.
And then I guess he was at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. But they, several groups had started to work on a live vaccine because there is this mystique that live virus vaccines are better, the attenuated vaccines, so-called attenuated live viruses. These are viruses that grow in the body but don't produce disease. An example of this would be like yellow fever vaccine is a live virus vaccine, smallpox vaccine, which you get. A vaccinia is the virus that's used. It's an attenuated live virus. It just produces a local pox-like lesion. And today, of course, all the viruses that are used for childhood diseases are all live virus vaccines. That is mumps, measles, rubella.
The new one, meningitis, the
no,
baby
that's
one?
That's a purified product.
Okay.
So with the experience with smallpox vaccine, yellow fever vaccine was already been widely used in the troops during the Second World War and was a very effective vaccine. Feeling was that live virus vaccines would be better for many reasons, scientific reasons, which they're still fighting about.
How do you feel about it?
Well, I think the live virus vaccines are fine. If they're like measles, mumps, and rubella, we have no problems with them. The polio vaccine has a problem, the live virus vaccine. And that is that all of the polio we have today in the United States is caused by the vaccine, except the imported cases. I mean, somebody comes from abroad and comes down, it's called an imported case. But all the cases in the United States, and there are only a few, there are only 8-10 cases a year of the 1 in 10 million people that are kids that are vaccinated, but they're called vaccine-associated cases. And that is, they occur in the vaccinee. The infants who are vaccinated come down with paralytic disease. Or they spread it to siblings or parents or contacts and who are not vaccinated properly, and they come down. So those are all vaccine-associated cases. That's the only polio we have. So that's the downside of the polio vaccine. And so they're very reluctant to change back, although the kill vaccine is still available. They've been very reluctant to change back to it because there's what they call the benefit-cost ratio. And benefit-risk ratio. And that is that if you went back to a kill vaccine, you'd have to give a vaccine that being used, it's licensed, it's multiple doses, and they're all given with a needle. And it's known that when you have a vaccine that has to be given by needle, first of all, it's more expensive. Everything's more expensive. The vaccine is more expensive because of the production methods and the amount of virus you need in the vaccine. The needle...
You're disposing it all now, aren't you, too?
So that it's known that if you had that the acceptance rate would go down, so that even we'd have even fewer people that would be vaccinated than there are today. Which is, there's still lots of people who aren't vaccinated, kids that aren't vaccinated, but it would be even less. So they say, the authorities say, pediatric authorities and health authorities say, that we stay with the live virus vaccine because we think if the society has to absorb the loss of those few people a year that come down in order to prevent many more from coming down. So it's a risk-benefit ratio that they're dealing with here. There are now attempts to have more potent kill vaccines that can be given in one dose, with schemes now being studied in clinically giving the kill vaccine first, one dose, and then feeding the other vaccine, the live virus vaccine. To this day, one difficulty with Sabin is that he never would admit that his vaccine caused any problems. He never would accept that. Still doesn't to this day. I mean, it's an unreasonable kind of blind spot and churlishness on his part, but he's a very dynamic, interesting man.
Is he a nice person?
Nice isn't a word I would use for him. He's dynamic, he's interesting, he's hard-headed, he's egomaniacal. Nice, I don't think that would be something.
How would you describe Dr. Salkman?
Smooth, glib, dynamic, muddle-headed, and self-absorbed. And has a much higher opinion of beliefs as press notices.
Yeah. Okay, statistically, prior to the vaccine, what percentage of children or people came down with the...
Oh, I don't have the rates, but I can tell you that there were between 18,000 and 30,000 paralytic cases of polio every year.
And today?
A major epidemic today. There's only less than a dozen.
Is there a chance, like what's happened with tuberculosis, that something, because of possibly not having the children inoculated like they should be, that something will happen again?
It happens. I mean, there are outbreaks. When they aren't vaccinated, there are outbreaks. There are outbreaks in the Amish in the last few years in Pennsylvania. They had an outbreak in central Pennsylvania among the Amish, who came back from some kind of religious meeting in Holland and came back and somebody was infected, didn't know it, and came back and spread it to unvaccinated kids. There's been outbreaks in Christian Science summer camps and unvaccinated children. So this still happens when you have unvaccinated people. This could happen. Fortunately, there's enough vaccinated people in the United States and so that there's a kind of a herd that the virus isn't spreading around as easily as it used to.
Do you think Mrs. Clinton, the wife of our new president, will be helpful in getting more benefits for children?
Well, the president has already said that he wants this universal childhood vaccination, and I think that it's kind of shameful that we haven't done that already, that we haven't seen fit to use these vaccines in a universal way for children and protect them. You can take it from both sides. One is the humanitarian side of just preventing illness and debility in children and the risk of permanent damage. The other thing is you can take an economic point of view, and that is it's well known that every dollar you spend on prevention saves, I don't know, the estimates are $10 to $100 on later care. So that economically, point of view of just medical economics, it makes good sense. Somebody's done, a few years ago, did the estimate of what the polio vaccine has saved since it started to be used in terms of medical costs, you know, having people in iron lungs and rehabilitation centers and paralytic people running around in wheelchairs and the care that's needed for people. It's billions and billions of dollars were saved by this vaccine and healthcare costs, in addition to alleviating and preventing suffering. Many people. So,
your inner feelings, there has to be something very unique in how you must feel about the work that you've done and what and the effect that it's had.
Of course. And as I told somebody recently who asked me this question, Jonas Salk certainly wasn't very generous with his colleagues, especially with me. But on the other hand, there's some merit in not having that kind of adulation and fame, because I was able to keep working and be productive. And actually, he never did another thing scientifically in the rest of his scientific life.
He really didn't.
Nothing. and whatever he did turned out to be a fiasco. But now he's got this company. He's on the board of directors, and they use his name to make this AIDS vaccine, which is a benighted idea. And he's doing the same thing with AIDS that he's trying to do with polio.
Do you think he's being used?
Jonas Salk is never used. He uses. Somebody sent me a prospectus for this company in California, and he and his family got lots of stock options in this company when it was a private company. And a year or so ago, it went public, and the stock that he got it for a quarter of a cent a share or something like that, millions of shares for himself and his family. And when it went public, it was $4 or $5 a share. So he's worth millions from that. You know, that whether he sold the shares or what, he can sell them any time. You know, to keep them. So, you know, nobody uses him. He did very well for himself. But this is never in public. I mean, and when it's talked about, it's never talked about that there's any financial gain that he can have on this. But it's a very good deal he got.
How about that
Salk
and Syrian employer? Is that just his name?
Well, that was that institute. You know what happened here. Pittsburgh wanted to keep him, and so he wanted more space, and they wanted to give him some kind of gift or symbol that would be in keeping with the event itself, and so. The lab was on the basement in the first floor of the old municipal hospital, which is now called Salk Hall. That's where the lab was. It was opposite where the medical school was, up in across from the stadium, where the dental school is now.
Just what, is that the soda, or?
That's on Terrace Street.
Terrace Street, okay.
Terrace between Lothrop and Barrow.
Okay.
And so money was raised to buy that building from the city. It was a white elephant by that time, because it was built as an infectious disease hospital in the 30s. I think it was opened like in 1940. And in 1940, antibiotics had come in already, and sulfa drugs. And so infectious disease hospitals were really passe already when it opened. They were obsolete. But it was used for polio. It had a ward on the third floor where they had many, many polio patients, iron lungs, and a terrible place to go.
Dr. Salk.
But anyway, they bought the hospital. I think that my information is correct. I don't have any personal knowledge of this, but I was told that the Jewish community, the millionaires in the Jewish community here, well-to-do people, put up the money to buy the building for the university from the city. And they bought the building. They raised the money to buy the building for the city and gave it to the university. And the university was going to make this into its institute. In the meantime, he was negotiating to go to California. And so after this was all settled, then he left and went to California with marbles and went to California, because the Polio Foundation now bought this beautiful property on the cliffs overlooking the Pacific. And they put up the money to build the Salk Institute.
That was the polio.
They put up the money, and they've endowed it for many years, and they still do giving money to it, for all I know. But they put up the money to build it, and this was the March of Dimes built it, and the March of Dimes funded it for a while. They had lots of other sources of money now, but
they became part of the United Fund, I think, ultimately.
I have no idea what the funding is now, but I know the foundation built it. He left Pittsburgh and left the building, and the building was turned into the dental school, but it was still kept its name of Salk Hall. So now it's the dental school, and the pharmacy.
Since there is a public audience, and then there's also a professional, your peer group, in your peer group, have you felt the recognition of?
Sure.
Dr. Salk had a has a brother who's a pediatrician. Is there any, did he ever have any relationship with him, or?
His brother who died recently?
Yes. He had sort of a nice reputation on his own as being a pediatrician. I think he wrote several books.
He wrote books, and yeah. He also had some strange ideas about, he's the one who had a device that he patented that made it sound like a heartbeat that you're supposed to put into the crib with the baby. He also had a brother, Herman, who was a veterinarian and who lived in the Pittsburgh area for some time and ran a farm for a wealthy Jewish philanthropist who had a farm outside of Northville somewhere named Mars. I can't remember the name of that, but he owned this big farm, and Herman Salt ran it and raised animals and sold it for the rabbits and chickens. And then Herman Salk, when his brother became famous, Herman Salk left Pittsburgh and moved to Palm Springs, California, and set up a practice, veterinary practice there, which dealt mainly with the psychiatric care of the animals and the stars.
Oh, I love.
That's wonderful. So did Dr. Salk, are you saying that he shared his wealth with his brother?
No, not at all. His brother just traded on his reputation.
Where